This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
Welcome to the GHIL podcast. I'm your host, Kim Koenig, and in this episode, I speak with Benno Gammel, Professor of History of Gender and Sexuality at the European University Institute in Florence, about the research underlying his lecture on Queering German History, Still a Vital and Viable Endeavor. In our conversation, we explore what it means to queer history, both as a critical practice and as a methodological approach for rethinking established historical narratives. Benno discusses why queering remains a vital tool for understanding German history and reflects on its implications for historiography more generally. We also consider how this perspective can offer valuable insights to scholars whose work may not explicitly engage with queer history. Welcome to the GHIL podcast. I'm sitting here with Benno Gammel to talk about his GHIL lecture on queering German history. And I want to jump right in. Your lecture asks the question in the title, is queering German history still a vital and viable endeavor? Why queering German history? Why queering German history now? Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, thanks for having me, first of all. Good morning, Kim. Why queering history and German history? Kind of the answer is because kind of it allows us to better and more fully understand German history in its complexity. Queer history, kind of German queer history, is full of highlights and very difficult, traumatic experiences. There is the persecution of, in particular, same-sex desiring men, but also trans people and lesbian women in the National Socialist period. But there is also the late 19th century and the Weimar period when the German emancipation movement was kind of leading and famous throughout the world. And there is kind of moments of progressiveness. And I think this combination is important, first of all. And then it's also, if you look, for example, at Imperial Germany, but also at the more recent past, bringing in the queer perspective allows us to understand how complicated and multi-layered things were and helps us to avoid shorthand understandings, for example, of Wilhelmine Germany as a militaristic and very hierarchical society, but also helps us to see the cracks in the self-image of the Federal Republic as a liberalizing endeavor with kind of the continued criminalization of same-sex desire well into the 1990s. And why now? I would always say, especially because there is kind of a tendency to silence certain stories and narratives and kind of a renewed emphasis on heteronormative worldview in the United States, in countries like Russia, but also in certain segments of German society. Therefore, I think it's all the more important to do queer history right now.
Definitely. For those listeners who are not familiar with the concept, can you tell us what queering actually means? Is there a difference between queer history and queering history?
Well, queering is the thing you do, right? And I think as it's, we do history and that's an active endeavor. It's kind of an engaging enterprise. And I think that is important to really rework how we narrate German history to not only bring same-sex desiring and gender non-conforming people into the limelight of kind of the books we write and the stories we tell, and that is also part of it, but to really fundamentally shift and question how we have so far understood history. So, for example, queering history also really entails a questioning what heterosexuality is and how clear-cut the distinction between heterosexuality and homosexuality really is. How clear-cut is the distinction between a kind of heteronormative understanding of gender as man, woman, and nothing in between? How can we find kind of aspects of gender nonconformity in what at first may come across as a totally normal, so normal here in quotation marks, as a totally normal setting? So kind of queering history means really challenge assumptions and perceptions that are pretty firmly ingrained in how we view the world and the past. And I think that is why queering is a verb.
I think, yeah, the verb very neatly leads us to my next question about the methodology. And of course, you just said we are very much ingrained by our current contemporary worldview. Specifically with queering and queer history, the question I always ask myself, how do you avoid reading modern identities onto historical figures who may not have used those terms? And how in the sources do you stay grounded to what people have actually experienced at the time?
I think that that is precisely the specific contribution that history can make, right? Because history is always about alterity, about, to a certain extent, not comprehending, right? Or kind of working towards enabling some form of comprehension across time. And that entails kind of categories that we use today, that we also use to understand the past, but kind of allowing the past to speak in its own right and to understand how, for example, gayness is something. I mean, you don't need to go back to the Middle Ages or the early modern times, or also in the 1970s, gayness was something very different from what it is nowadays. And I think this is already part of the queering project, right? To destabilize those categories, not in order to dispute their validity and their, you know, right to exist, but to open them up for all the possibilities they entail. And possibilities, if you think about them historically, that means things might have been different possibilities in the past, but things may also become different in the future. And I think this is why the historical contribution here is super important.
Can you tell us a bit more about your sources? Because as you rightly say, queer history and queer experiences have often been silenced by other people, silenced by the people themselves. What kind of sources do you work with?
Well, I primarily work with oral history interviews, and I did a lot of work and research with gay magazines, lesbian magazines, so things that came out in print, in particular since the 1970s, but also in the 50s and 60s, although it was more difficult then. But also in the 1920s, you have kind of a very lively culture, subculture of periodicals for same-sex desiring audiences and gender nonconforming audiences. So that is important. There's, of course, a lot of research done with police sources, the sources of the authorities and organizations that were behind the persecution. But there is also diaries, letters. It's always or often kind of, especially in the early days of queer history, other colleagues would say, you're never going to find anything and it's going to be so difficult. But turns out almost with every project, I'm now supervising students that work on the queer history of Poland and other places. And once you start to look for it, you find it. I think there's also kind of important to look in sometimes in places where you would not necessarily expect, right? That's what I also meant when I said like heterosexuality can be queerly understood. So it's not just the usual suspects, but you can also kind of reread, for example, literary texts and find things that if you kind of, you know, you look at them without your queer glasses, not through the queer lens, those aspects may have remained unexplored. And there is research now also on popular novels, for example, in Weimar Germany and the queer elements there. So there's many possibilities to do research and to kind of allow the queer past at least to speak towards us from the sources we find in the archives or elsewhere.
Yeah, and I find it very interesting. I mean, I think there's often a tendency to fall into this trap of telling a progress narrative where, you know, society gets progressively more progressive. But in your lecture, you say you specifically want to argue against that and also argue against the simple rise, fall, rise again story. Can you tell us a bit more about what you mean by that and give us concrete examples, for example, how progress for some groups meant a setback for others and vice versa?
Sure. I think, in the talk, I look at all the different periods of German history since the late 19th century. If you look at Imperial Germany, so late 19th, early 20th century, you already find that I mentioned kind of the early homosexual emancipation movement. But at the same time, of course, it is a time of repression and persecution. So you find the two dynamics in combination and conjunction with one another. And it's important to see that complexity. And that's also true if we're looking at the last 50 years since the 1970s. So when we see this, shall we say, new emancipation movement, lesbian feminist movement, gay movement in the Federal Republic, but also in the GDR, we see groups emerging in the 70s and 1980s. So there is kind of that sense of things changing for the better. There is, of course, slowly, but kind of things do change. And we have the decriminalization of male same-sex desire, first in the GDR, and then as a consequence of this, also in West Germany in 1994. And later then, the sentences against same-sex desiring men are revoked by the German parliament in the 2000s. And finally, there's marriage for all. So, you know, things do change for the better. I'm not disputing that. But at the same time, we also see HIV and AIDS in the 1980s and kind of a huge backlash that follows that. We see continued right-wing violence against our queer people in the 1980s and throughout since then. So it's that's what I call the simultaneity of emancipation, stigmatization, so the continued stigma against queer people, societal stigma against queer people, and normalization. There is also a process within which gender and sexual diversity become kind of more and more normal and integrated into a broadening spectrum of possibilities of gender positions and sexual lifestyles. So I think it's important to see those dynamics together and not to just go for the progressive liberalization narrative and to emphasize how it all gets better almost necessarily. There is kind of these contradictory developments happen simultaneously, and they do so today as well. We see an increase in violence against trans people, against queer people. We see continued emancipation struggles, discussions about asylum for people who are persecuted in their home countries and come to Western Europe. We see, depictions of queer people on the television that can be kind of clearly read as a sign of normalization. So it's these things happening together, which also requires activists to respond to that complex situation. Right. And I don't know, kind of, you also asked about how one group benefits from and other groups kind of suffer at the same time. So that is, you could describe that as the intersectional question, right? That in some respects, for example, gay men at times benefited from certain developments by distancing themselves, for example, from gender nonconforming people and cross-dressing people, claiming kind of a certain group of gay men, I'm claiming for themselves social acceptance by distancing themselves from other groups that they deemed less acceptable or disreputable. You see similar things when you look at same-sex prostitution. So middle-class men, for example, in the 1920s, claiming for themselves acceptance and protection against police violence and police persecution at the cost of often working-class young men who engaged in sex work. So these things, of course, also happened and are also important to keep in mind when thinking about the shall we say, real-time complexity of historical and present-day situations.
Yeah, I think you make a very powerful point about, you know, making queer history more relevant to German history at large or history at large. So lastly, I would like to ask how historians working in other fields, not specifically in queer history, can approach including queer perspectives of queering into their work.
I think this is really crucial, right? And that's why it's also important to write books that kind of broaden the view, and also like my book on queer German history, address a broader audience to kind of build these kinds of bridges. And I think it already happens, right? People, it's a certain kind of openness to see things that are there. If you do research on marriage, for example, and then you realize that not every heterosexual marriage is so exclusively heterosexual as it may come across at first sight, right? To at least have in mind the possibility that people who have kind of a perfect heterosexual life might also engage in other forms of sexual encounters. To keep in mind when thinking about health insurance or pension systems, that not all people, I think that's for example, I think it's a good example, right? Not all people in their way of life follow the normative model that is inscribed into these social security systems of what is sometimes called as a nuclear family. So heterosexual marriage and reproduction within heterosexual marriage. And once you begin to think that way around, you also open up perspectives on single people, right? I think that's also, there is kind of a couple of aspects that tend to be not excluded, but kind of not very prominent, but that are actually important, right? And to acknowledge the possibility that there is a clear hegemonic norm, but there is also a sizable group of people who do not conform, and what certain policy measures, what certain criminal law regulations mean for these people, that should be a question that all historians have in mind. And then, you know, sometimes you might suddenly come across something and that allows you to reconsider and open up fresh perspectives and come up with intriguing new observations on what before you might have thought was a completely straight topic, like social security systems.
Yeah, I think this is a great and powerful call to end on. Our listeners hopefully enjoy this interview as much as we did, and of course, listen to your lecture as well. Thank you so much for talking to us on the GHIO podcast today.
And it's hope to see you soon. Pleasure. Yes.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.